Hey folks, I'm Dan Dworkis, and this is the Emergency Mind Podcast, a space where we bring together lessons from the emergency department and beyond about performing at our best when it matters the most and applying knowledge under pressure. All right, I am super excited for this. This has been a long time coming, a bunch of emails exchanged, but actually this dates back like years to me being a resident to starting to have some great conversations with my guest today, who is Dr. Chris Baugh. I'm going to let Chris introduce himself in a second, but I want to say that if you're doing the math here, you might notice that this should theoretically be episode 100 instead of 101. But there's a very specific thing I've been trying to do for episode 100, and the logistics are still escaping me. And frankly, my podcast, my rules. So we're going to pretend this is episode 101 instead of 100. So all of that said, Chris, thank you so much for joining on this weirdly 101st episode. I am delighted to have you, and I'm so psyched to have this conversation.
Dan, it's an extreme pleasure to be talking to you today. One of the pleasures of being an academic emergency physician is interacting with trainees, but then very often following up with them to see how they're doing in their careers after they graduate and go out into the world and do great things. And you are certainly on that list. So it's a pleasure to catch up with you and talk a bit about our experiences together and my perspectives.
Absolutely. I'm certainly on the list of residents, if not the residents doing useful things in the universe. I completely agree. I was getting set up for this and I was digging back through my email archives and I found some exchange between us from like 2015 about me trying to pitch you on some project about OBS in general, right? Because I think that operation and observation medicine and a lot of this stuff has been a huge centerpiece of your career, at least to launch you in some of the directions that you've been doing. And I guess before we get into that, do you want to take a second and for folks that don't know you and just like 30,000 foot overview, what do you focus on and what are you up to?
Sure. I'm an academic emergency physician, right? So I see patients in the emergency department. That's my clinical role, but I work in an academic center. So I work at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. I'm an associate professor of emergency medicine at Harvard Medical School. And I would say my leadership and academic niche has been around operations. Going back to when I was in medical school, I went to Penn. I did a five-year combined MD-MBA. So I went to Wharton for 2 years, spent some time in management consulting. And at that point, got very interested in operations, finance, you know, systems practice. And so when I decided that my clinical niche was going to be emergency medicine, I came to the same residency that you trained in at Brigham and Women's and Mass General. And I think one of my goals during that training period was to find my niche that overlapped clinical emergency medicine and that operations finance interest that I had. And observation medicine ended up being that. I was very fortunate to have great mentors and be in the right time and place to really explore that. And for those of you who may not be familiar with observation medicine, it's really the intersection of acute unscheduled care that we do in the emergency department and kind of inpatient admissions, which are classic hospitalizations, right? Mm-hmm. So this is typically a dedicated space within or adjacent to an emergency department where patients can get additional time. So delay that admission decision for further diagnostics or treatments to see if they really truly need to be an inpatient or not. And very often they don't need to be. About 80% on average from these observation units can actually go home usually the next day. And I felt like it was a really underappreciated resource in healthcare. And so a lot of my career has been defining protocols and operational characteristics to really run observation units at kind of best practice.
I guess I'll start this podcast out by publicly apologizing to you for all of the times that I fought you on that kicking and screaming as a resident. I think it's a really interesting thing to think through that as you operate on emergency teams, whether they're mission critical teams or medical teams or whatever, you tend to select for folks that really like to do parts of it, right? Like we like the high intensity resuscitation. We like the chaos. We feel at home in that. And often at the same time, these teams have dual roles where they're also doing lower acuity, lower intensity work, or they're bouncing back and forth between sort of a high acuity world and a low acuity world, because they have to do both of those in order to do their job well. And I was, let's just call it, sometimes resistant to that. And I'm sorry, because I think that's a really key thing to think about is how you design not just the systems, but the people that interface with the systems to do both of those jobs well. What did that feel like for you when you were starting? I assume I'm not the only one that was a little bit, I don't know, recalcitrant, I guess I'd say.
No, that's a great point. And this is something that colleagues of mine at other institutions who are trying to expand or start up an observation unit kind of are facing, is that resistance from the emergency medicine staff who are not very interested in extending their scope to own these observation patients that they had historically just placed on an inpatient service, even if they weren't an inpatient. These are patients that you might be caring for 24 hours, 36 hours after they initially arrived to the ED. And traditionally, that's not the job of an emergency physician. Usually, we're doing an acute resuscitation or evaluation 3, 5, 7 hours in. We're making a home versus hospital decision and moving on. And to have people take a step back and say, actually, there's a subset of these patients with, name the disease, cellulitis, failure, chest pain, that are really great candidates for this limited time, additional diagnostics, treatments, who can probably go on the next day. And it does require kind of additional knowledge and comfort of saying like, okay, well, this heart failure patient, I'm not just going to start diuresis. I'm actually going to reevaluate after they've been diuresed, check electrolytes, see if they need another set of diuresis, and then make a decision a whole day later. And so making the staff feel very supportive when you're asking them to learn new things is a big lesson learned for me. And that means creating really well-designed protocols, using content experts. So bringing the cardiologists into the chest pain protocol, the gastroenterologists into a GI bleed protocol, making sure that they're aware that there are certain triggers for consultation or support that the ED staff may need to call on them for, and that they're willing to stand tall and be a resource if needed, as the protocol will dictate. Otherwise, the emergency medicine staff feels very supported in following the protocol around patient selection, what kind of things we're doing for patients in OBS, and then what we're doing for endpoints to make that final disposition decision.
And we see this across different domains that we operate in the Emergency Mind Project and Mission Critical as well. The constant expansion and evolution of what the mission of some of these teams are. Right? The nature of emergency medicine is changing, and emergency physicians have the option to either see that as a bad thing and scope creep, for lack of a better word, or as a good thing, which is that our mission is unscheduled acute care, and this is part of it. So how do we do a better job at our mission? And it's just such a fascinating thing to me to think about how to manage that change and evolution well, because I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon. And I would imagine emergency medicine and fields that deal with emergencies in general are going to continue to change. We're seeing the, I was having a conversation recently with some folks talking about how as AI powers more vehicles differently, all of a sudden you're getting, instead of a conversation between an operator and a coach, you're now getting an operator, vehicle, and coach triad that are having to talk to each other, right? We're going to start seeing these interesting, fascinating, disruptive waves coming through emergency medicine as well, as we already are. And watching us manage that change is fascinating.
Medicine is evolving. I think we're having an aging population with more comorbidities. It's not so simple just to discharge patients. We're seeing a lot of patients who have many active issues going on, but no one of them that kind of really needs inpatient care. A lot of them have kind of mobility or physical therapy needs that can be addressed in an observation unit that doesn't necessarily need inpatient care. Mm-hmm. Plus, our inpatient colleagues are so challenged with patient flow out of the hospital with respect to post-acute care rehab, and those inpatient census are getting so high. And what are they really good at? They're good at really sick, complicated inpatients, right? Patients who don't have an extremely short length of stay. If we're talking about the 12 to 24 hour patient, that's not where their strengths are. And God bless them for their strengths, because I need those people to take over the care of my truly sick inpatients, right? But if there's a patient I can redirect to an observation unit, spare that inpatient census, and still deliver excellent care to that observation patient, then it feels like a win for all parties.
We talk a lot about this idea in medicine of practicing at the top of your license, right? Using the highest and best use of your skill sets. So is your team doing the thing that's truly in their sweet spot? And can you take as much as possible off the plate of everybody else and help them work at their best point like that? I think that's actually a natural transition into one of the things that came up, which is why I wanted to have this conversation with you in general, which is some of these multidisciplinary rapid response teams that are being used in the middle of emergency departments to rapidly bring together a disparate group of specialists to solve a super complicated problem. So we talk a lot in the podcast about swarm teams, right? About the idea of like a code blue team activated somewhere in the hospital where you get a bunch of people that don't know each other coming together, self-assembling, self-organizing, working a problem set, and then disbanding. And in many ways, what we're about to talk about is similar to that, but in some pretty crucial ways, it's also a little bit different, which is that these teams, these problem-solving teams that we're about to discuss, are really designed for a very particular issue. They're designed to come together and solve one thing and to solve that really well. First off, is there a good name for these teams? Like, do you have a good thing that you use for them? Because it's not quite a swarm team. It's something a little different, but.
Yeah, I traditionally refer to them as code teams, and we have various different codes. I think the last time I counted, we have 7 or 8 of them. All our trauma activations, ST elevation, myocardial infarction, or our key heart attack code, or stroke code. You go on and on. And there is a risk in having too many of these codes because there's specific definition as to when to activate and what happens. And you can lose track of those, especially if you're not calling these codes on a very regular basis. When I think about these, want to balance utility or usefulness of when they work really well versus having to replicate that code by doing all the independent actions that kind of adds up to the code team versus having that team functioning very automatically and well to do what it's intended to do, which is rapid multidisciplinary kind of assessment and care of our sickest patients.
Can we pick one example, one of the code teams that you've been involved in that we can just talk through the origin of it, the effectiveness of it, like how it works and what it looks like?
Sure. I would say one of the ones that I've been working on more recently is our code pulmonary embolism team.
For those of you listening to this that are not medical, what we're talking about is the sudden stoppage or the sudden blood clot or venous thromboembolism in the blood vessels between the heart and the lungs, right? A pulmonary embolism. This is very bad for you, ultimately potentially leading to death and potentially death quite quickly and quite difficult to fix, fully, right? So there's like a lot of issues that come up with this, and the rapid diagnosis and management of pulmonary embolisms is a pretty key activity of emergency rooms, small and large, right? So there's a big reason to have one of these things. So Chris, what does that look like? What does a pulmonary embolism team look like? How do you decide like the efferent, like what are the triggers? How do you activate it? Who shows up and how does this look?
So this lives in a document. And so there's some cases that are quite obvious, right? So you have some patients who you've diagnosed a pulmonary embolism in who have hypotension, right? They're in shock. They have a low blood pressure. These patients need a very aggressive resuscitation. And you suspect they may need something in addition to just a systemic blood thinner. We usually put these patients on heparin. Sure. They might need surgery to remove clot. And they're probably going to need an ICU bed as well. And so what we're activating is a multidisciplinary team that includes either vascular medicine or cardiology. We have kind of experts in both that rotate that medical specialist role in pulmonary embolism, as well as a cardiac surgeon. And so that team is going to include both fellow and attending in those medical and surgical subspecialties. And then they're going to look at imaging. They're going to look at the patient. They're going to talk to the emergency physician and make a recommendation around candidacy for those more advanced treatments.
I have a patient and I diagnose them with a problem or a potential problem that fits the bill, right? I'm able to say, okay, previously, before this moment of crisis, we have had a bunch of meetings. We've discussed throughout the hospital that, hey, we can bring multidisciplinary, high-powered work to bear at the point of the spear for this one patient if it looks like this. Okay, hey, this meets our definition. We're going to fire off this code page or this code announcement. And what we're going to expect to happen is that really high-level experts at very specific skills convene in the emergency department at the moment and location of need of this one patient and have a high-level multidisciplinary discussion about what to do next. I'm reading that right?
That's right. It's essentially a page group that gets activated by the emergency physician. Then it goes out to those specialists who will then convene to make an assessment and recommendation. And you get immediate access to them and a more expedited, I think, treatment recommendation than you would otherwise by individually accessing each of those specialists in serial to one another.
So if you're listening to this and you're not in medicine, you're like, why are we even talking about this? Who cares? The answer is that it's actually very complicated to get a group of disparate experts at the top of their level to come together at a moment in time when you need it in order to think about something. Other than emergency or trauma care, that's not really how most of our systems are set up, right? Our systems are set up where junior people think things through, present to senior people. There's a debate and a discussion within a particular silo. Those silos talk to each other laterally. Everybody makes a coherent plan over time, and eventually something happens. There are lots of advantages to doing it that way too, but it's really hard to snap that system into gear when a patient needs you to make a complex, multidimensional, multidisciplinary decision quickly. So this is a really fascinating shortcut. And as we talk in general on the podcast about the different types of teams and how they operate under pressure, it's a very unique system that brings everybody to bear in this one moment in time. So that's why I'm so fascinated about this, right? Can you talk us through a little bit what behind the scenes looks like? So what does it take to build one of these things? What are those conversations like? What are the challenges of setting this up? You mentioned one, which is that there's an energy and time commitment cost to it. So you don't want to use them egregiously, and you don't want to set up too many of them. But what else does it look like to build this thing from the ground up?
I think it starts with the realization that there's a gap in care. And typically, these are scenarios where time is of the essence, even more so than other things in the emergency department, where you can argue that every second, every minute kind of ticking by and delay in some definitive treatment puts the patient at increasing risk, right? Mm-hmm. And so once you have data, have cases where there could have been a more speedy response, then you basically have a conversation with the leadership, the operational leadership of all the stakeholders, right? You say, hey, I suspect there's an opportunity to do better here. And working at a place like where I work at Brigham and Women's Hospital, I think we have kind of a unique responsibility to be innovators here because of how well-resourced the hospital is, right? And so I can have access to an in-house vascular medicine specialist, cardiac surgeon, et cetera. That's not the case in many other emergency departments. So I think it gives me the opportunity to think very broadly around how to improve care and have those resources available as a solution. If I was in a community hospital, I would be looking to transfer these patients very often. And then once you get buy-in from those stakeholders, then it's a matter of, okay, can we get a shared set of definitions, right? Let's look at the literature. What does high-risk pulmonary embolism look like? Are there physiologic criteria we can all agree on? Are there authoritative guidelines that we can reference? And then once we're agreeing on that, you can imagine this kind of shared document being built out through many iterations. And then it gets to a point where it's shareable, right? So then we bring it back to our constituents to say, this is what we want to do, get feedback. Once you finalize it, you get institutional approval. There's a medical staff executive committee that can sign off that says this is a good idea. And then it's implemented, right? And then you, of course, have to do education. You have to present it at all the different stakeholder conferences, including, you know, nursing and trainee groups, maybe our physician assistant group, et cetera. And then you have to have a place where people can reference it in real time in the emergency department, right? To say, oh, I just remember hearing about this code pulmonary embolism. Let me see if this patient in front of me meets criteria. Let me pull the document up and reference it and say, how do I activate it if I need to? And then it's ultimately something that needs to be continuously maintained and revised, right? I think must be on our fourth or fifth generation of document. And it seems like every year we're making substantial changes as to who's on the code team, criteria for activation, et cetera. So it's very much a living document that gets improved all the time.
As we're talking about this, there's emerging a shape of the type of problem that this team would be good at solving, right? And that problem is a gap in care and the need for a rapid multidisciplinary discussion group or rapid multidisciplinary action team to solve that problem. It has to happen at a relatively high frequency, right? If this type of thing happened like once every 10 years, this probably isn't the right type of solution for it. It has to happen at a frequency that is high enough where people are suffering from it, but probably not constantly, right? This wouldn't be something, because there's a cost to activating this team. You're pulling all these operators away from something else. So there's a risk-benefit calculation to the type of problem that you'd be designing one of these teams for.
That's the calculus that needs to go into that, right? It has to happen often enough to be worthwhile, but not so often that it's too disruptive to other workflows. Because we really do ask people to stop what they're doing and focus on this. And it's one of those things where everybody gets prioritized, then no one's prioritized. And so you have to have that balance between the two.
And probably if it were the thing that happened constantly, we would be developing other types of systems and other types of structures to solve this problem.
That's right. We may think about like a different staff role or some other resource that would be dedicated to this.
Sure.
Although if you think about an emergency department that has 50 or 70 or 100,000 annual visits and like all the different types of codes, we do overhead announce in addition to page when a code is activated. And it's not unusual over the course of a, say, 9-hour emergency department shift to hear a few different codes get announced overhead in various parts of the department. But any one of the codes may not happen as frequently as others.
Okay, so let's say we've picked out a problem that fits this bill, right? It happens at roughly the right frequency. There's a gap. It's potentially addressable. We believe we can make a difference with a multidimensional team attacking the problem set. You talked a little bit about almost like wargaming it out with the heads of the other groups at a high level and thinking about like, what could this look like? What do we want this to look like? And like maybe drifting here a little bit into work as done versus work as imagined and some of the stuff that gets around that. But how do you make the calculus about what type of a response you should bring together?
Well, I think we talk about what the ideal is, right? We do a lot of kind of patient flow mapping or patient journey as to what the evidence tells us is what we should be doing for our patients, right? Like if we could have it be ideal, what would the steps be? Who would be involved? When would things happen? And then ultimately, once we introduce this, we do quality review, right? To see if it's actually happening the way that we want it to. And if it's not, we have to go back and look at our model and say what needs to change to get it closer to that ideal.
This is perfect. This is the next thing I want to think about is, okay, so the high up level folks design a theoretical plan. We know what right looks like. What right looks like is these people convening here and making this decision set, and that's going to hopefully fix this gap in care that we have. How do we roll that out for the people on the operating edge of this, right? For the doctors and nurses who are on shift, for the fellows and attendings who are the cardiologists? Because one of the things we know from working in the emergency department is that those conversations can either be incredibly powerful in the sense that they get learning done, they get care done, and they make all of us better than the sum of our parts, or they can go the other direction, right? We can create enormous amounts of friction and we can gunk up the works and make 1 and 1 equal to 0.7 as opposed to 14, right? So like, how do we do that? How do we roll out these multidisciplinary teams at the cutting edge?
Well, I think there's that in-service kind of education component that gets simultaneously rolled out to the people who need to know about it, who are going to be accessing and interacting with it. I think another piece that's helpful is real-time access to the guidance that is shared, right? It's the same document that our emergency physicians are looking at for kind of the source of truth as the cardiac surgery fellow. They're not getting different guidance. And so if we're all kind of working off the same guidance that has a version date, it has authorship, accountability, so that if there's a problem with how it worked, there is that follow-up that happens to say someone is not on the same page and needs some education, or as well-intentioned as this was, it's not working in real life like we wanted to, and we need to actually change the process.
So there's institutional and multidisciplinary buy-in to it. There's the sense of, hey, we're doing this together. The other thing I'm hearing from you is the sense of, hey, we're doing this together as an experiment. We think this will work, but we're not 1,000% sure, and we're going to figure it out together as we go. Am I reading that right?
I think that's absolutely right. Certainly a lesson that I've learned over two decades in medicine is, you know, the proverb of, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I've made the mistake of saying, I feel in my bones that this is the right answer, and I'm just going to plow through with saying, we're starting this next Monday. Even if that was the right answer, it's not the right way to implement it. And I've been less successful in my early career in those situations versus saying, okay, I absolutely need buy-in from this group. Even if the version doesn't change materially, having that conversation and getting that buy-in is absolutely a necessary step prior to this being live. And so there's certainly that component. One of the great things about my experience working where I have for my entire career at this point is this kind of sense of innovation, piloting. I think people are very open to the concept of a pilot, especially if the intention of the pilot is to improve care for patients. And that's very explicit in the beginning. People are more willing, I think, to give feedback if it's framed as a pilot. And then that pilot might turn into our standard operating procedure. It may not, but it often does. And so I think getting people to embrace that kind of continuous improvement culture is an important part of getting it right.
Yeah. And like magic also, right? Like that's totally magic. Right. I think like it's so wonderful to work in a space that has that level of acceptance of evolution and change. Right. Like I feel like from my time there a while back now, right. But like if nothing changed over the course of a year or several months, I think people would be like, what are we doing? We're not pushing the edge enough right now. Like we're not really trying to make this happen. But there's this sense that like we're going to dial it in through practice. And we're all going to be willing to be a little uncomfortable and do that. That's a pretty magical culture that has that in there.
I think that's right. I think that's part of what makes me so excited to come to work every day, two decades in, to the emergency department, which historically is a place that is seen as high risk for burnout or moral injury. And I still am loving it. Like I am working more clinically today than I ever have since being a resident. Let's make it
right
clear.
On.
Residents yeah. in our PAs and our nurses work way more than the attendings.
Sure.
But I think that's being part of that team. And a certain, and I say team very explicitly, because I feel like you have to embrace that team approach within the emergency department, right? So you have the ED staff team component, but then also seeing the consultants and the staff from other parts of the department as also part of that, a larger team as well, working through that same goal of delivering the best care we can to our patients. Like if you really believe that, then showing up to work is a joy, even under very stressful circumstances, which we certainly are facing in the emergency department right now.
Yeah, very true. Very true. You mentioned a couple minutes ago here that we're on version like 4 or 5 or whatever of the PE response team document. What are some of the types of things that have changed over the iterations of that? Maybe that question is better answered about that response team, or maybe it's answered in general, like, when you see these things evolve, are there themes in what changes?
I would say keeping it simple is definitely a lesson. Like the earlier versions of the code had like tiered activation. Mm-hmm. And now we have essentially one level of activation that is more simple. And it does allow those people responding once they get the minimum data set to make a determination if it's a less severe case. They have the option to peel off. They don't have to reschedule their whole afternoon. They could be like, okay, like asked and answered. There's no need for further advanced treatments. We can move on. Another thing was very special, less common scenarios that not necessarily merit a surgical approach, but were very kind of high risk, right? So we call a saddle PE, so a big clot right in a vulnerable area where the patient is currently stable, but could decompensate at any point. Think about patients with contraindications to blood thinners. Other scenarios where having that kind of team approach would have been very helpful in retrospect. And so the idea of expanding the criteria carefully, but based on real situations that we encountered, was another piece. We went full circle on the involvement of surgeons, right? Like the initial protocol had the surgeons involved, and then we decided to take them out, and now they're back in. So that happens sometimes too, where you evolve to pull things back in that were removed for one reason or another, but then you get enough experience under your belt to say, even though this resource isn't needed every time, when we need it, we really need it. And we'd rather be able to call them off than scramble to pull them into a case when we could have used them earlier.
That's super interesting. And like inherent in what you're saying is the sort of clear-headed scientific approach that we don't know if this first thing is going to work. We're going to try some stuff. We're going to tinker with it. We're going to work on it. We think we're going to continually get better at this, but we don't know what shape that's going to take. And so we're willing to move around in a circle and come back at an answer for a different reason and be happy with that as a thing.
I think that's right. It's my approach to academic writing too, which is like the first draft doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be written. And we're going live with a first draft that's been vetted for many hours through lots of smart people, right? So it's not like we're just throwing something out that we came up with in an afternoon. But that being said, like, I think there's a lot of kind of paralysis in trying to make things perfect. There's a lot of things that would be improved by just piloting something that's very good and then being willing to iterate on that to make it better and better.
The minimum viable product approach to response teams. But we talked a minute ago about what it takes to have that discipline of allowing for and embracing uncertainty and discomfort and growth by running these teams. What else do you think it takes to be a successful operator on one of these teams?
I think when you're on the end of calling one of these codes, you learn very quickly what the essential pieces of information are that's going to be asked of you when this team starts to call back. Learn how the specialists think about these patients and what goes into their decision making. And I think after you've done it a few times, you realize what they're going to be asking for. So you make sure you get the information from the patient.
Sure.
Before sending out that page. I think that helps people talk the same language, if you will. And so, as you can imagine, these conversations are brief and focused. And ultimately, if you don't have the information that the consultant needs, you're going to cause a delay, maybe frustration, miscommunication. And so you learn very quickly how to efficiently communicate.
So when you're calling in resources to your position, you want to make sure that you're clear about what your ask is. And you want to make sure that you're setting up your call in a way that the resource team is able to hear it and understand it.
That's right. And very often what they're going to make a decision on is whether some advanced treatment that could have a lot of risks involved with it, right? Taking someone to a cath lab or to the OR is going to be the risk benefit is to take the patient. And so I need to be able to communicate the factors that go into that determination very quickly when that consultant calls back.
Do you all, when you're building these response teams, and you're thinking about how it'll go, do you game out what that conversation looks like? Like, is part of the thing, okay, we will activate in criteria in XYZ, and the initial transfer of information will include the following. Is that gamed out, or is it left up to, chance is the wrong word, right? Because we all operate in systems that have these teams, so we're not new to what you're describing in general. Like, we've called in other teams or something, but to what extent does that actually, like, land?
Yeah. Well, I think given that there is a fair amount of variation in kind of patient factors, presentation, delayed presentation, kind of response to initial therapies, et cetera, that it's, I think, impossible to game out all the possible information that could need to go out there. But I see what you're saying around minimum data set. Sometimes in the emergency department, our minimum data set's very minimal, right? We have a patient found down who doesn't even have an identity, who we don't have any past medical history on, we can't interview them, and we're trying our best to get to a diagnosis. Once we do, we're then calling for help. And so for this pulmonary embolism example, it could be someone who we get to CAT scan, we confirm a PE, but we don't know if they're on blood thinners, we don't know what their history is, whether they have metastasis from cancer in their brain. Like, all the things that might go into a blood thinner or a blood clot treatment strategy, we don't have. And so there are certain elements that I think the documents can guide a conversation around, but ultimately one of the other things that we try and do is try not to make the documents too cumbersome, right? Especially if we're expecting somebody to be referencing these in real time with a sick patient, by definition, that if it's too long, right, it's like, oh, this is a very comprehensive 25-page document. It's not going to be useful at the bedside. Mm-hmm. So the sweet spot's probably like a 2 or 3 page Word document that they can reference, where it gives the essentials and then really gets people together. And I think experience oftentimes will get people thinking about the key factors. And so I certainly, as an attending, now that I've been doing this for a number of years, those conversations tend to go much easier. And you probably, you know, I certainly had that experience when I was a resident, when I'd call a consult and I'm like, wow, that conversation did not go really well, because I wasn't aware of how the consultant thought and what information they needed from me.
Yeah.
And so it was like, a good question. I don't know. I'll have to call you back. And then they would get frustrated and I'd be like, why are they so frustrated? Why did that conversation go so poorly? And now as an attending, I'm like calling and I'm like, oh, this is exactly what you need to know. And they're like, great. Thank you so much. I'm like, oh, that was easy.
It's always different when you have more reps in, and when you know your counterparts, right? When you've worked at a hospital for a long time and you're able to be like, hey, Chris, look, I know this doesn't totally fit the bill here, but I need you to come down. Let's look at this together, right? That's gold and works incredibly well when it's there and is pretty challenging when it's not.
I'm so glad you made that point. Some of the conversations we have, again, with like imperfect information, rely on a certain amount of trust, right? And that trust comes easy when you have an existing relationship, right?
Absolutely.
I know this doesn't sound quite right, but trust me here. If you don't have an existing relationship, and the worst example is like when people identify themselves by their specialty, not even their names, right? So it's so impersonal and you don't have that trust, then that's where you have that conflict, right? Where now we're escalating things, there's clear tension, we're not aligned. And that's a hard part of the job, right? To have to face all the challenges that are implicit in emergency medicine, but then also have these specialist conflict to manage on top of that.
Sure. Yeah, you're navigating these complex relationships that are under pressure. And it's interesting that you say that, because I think at some of the places I've worked on the West Coast, it is actually the default to identify yourself by specialty, right? And the conversations are like, hello, cardiology, this is ER, like blah, blah, blah. And then you talk. And then eventually at the end, you're like, oh, hey, what's your name, by the way? And I'm curious, like, that works really well. That works really well, for example, if you're responding to a cardiac arrest in the hospital somewhere, your code team, nobody really cares that you're Dan. They want to know that you're ER, right? At least to start the conversation. But it's the opposite for what you're saying when you're not in that circumstance. There's a huge value to being able to be like, hey, I'm Dan. This is what I'm bringing. Here's like, who are you? Can we have this conversation person to person? But recognizing when you're switching between what my colleague Preston Klein would call routine versus critical communication moments is pretty clutch in there. And I think that's harder to do when you're less experienced. It's not as obvious when you've crossed that threshold, I think.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I suppose there are times when you're leading a team or walking into a situation where your specialty is going to be really important to announce to the room. Mm-hmm. And that might make sense to say, like, I'm the interventional cardiology fellow. You know, let me see the EKGs for this question, STEMI.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important when there's an opportunity, there usually is, to then also have that moment of humanity to be like,
absolutely. You know, yeah.
And that could happen maybe after that introduction in those critical situations, but that's rare to be in that critical of a situation where you can't identify who called you and be like, oh, hey, Dan, I'm Chris. I'm covering the interventional cardiology pager today. Do you mind showing me the EKGs you were concerned about or something like that? And then you end up kind of building those relationships. And if you're working in a hospital over time, I think it just and this smooths those interactions in the way I was referring to earlier.
Yeah, I think that's very smart. So we've talked about the idea of these multidisciplinary response teams. We talked about the shape of the problem they're going to be designed to fit. We talked about a little bit about the steps in building them, about hashing them out ahead of time as work is imagined. We talked a little bit about executing them. We talked a little bit about what it takes for somebody to be a member of one of them. And we even talked a little evolving them and learning from them. What are we missing? Is there anything as I say that arc that you're like, oh, you also really need to think about?
Yeah, I think we probably don't spend enough time truly on a systematic level looking at outcomes and performance of the teams, right? Like, I think we do it piecemeal. Like, we get a sense that a particular code response did not go well and that was through peer review or something like that. But that feels like a bit of a one-off. I feel like there's an opportunity to probably more systematically look at key metrics, and the metrics probably differ according to each type of code activation. For a stroke activation, for ischemic stroke, it might be like very tight time intervals from like arrival, the stroke team activation, to CT scan, to TPA. Totally. But for other less well-defined codes, like a trauma activation, it may not be clear that in every case, the patient should go directly to the OR, to the CAT scan, or something like that, right? So it may be hard to define those more standardized time intervals, but there might be other metrics that people can agree upon kind of mean a good trauma response. And we probably could do a better job of systematically looking at those and holding ourselves accountable to that continuous improvement retrospectively. I think we would all be better off if we did that a little bit, I guess, more rigorously.
Yeah. Now that makes a lot of sense. You said that I had this very vivid memory of it being July 1st at Brigham, and it was my first day as a PGY3. So I was running traumas for the first day, and it was a trauma team activation at like 7:01 a.m. after I inherited the role at 7 a.m. when the brand new surgery resident and I, with no attendings and nobody else in the room, decided that we would take the patient to the OR. And thankfully, we were stopped by other people who were like, oh, what are you doing? Like, you have no idea. But we thought we were it. We thought we were the whole trauma team activation, right? So speed is not necessarily the only metric that we want to go on. And thankfully, no harm came to that patient, by the way, sidebar, everything's fine. But
that's such an important role. That's a coming of age experience for every emergency resident when you run your first trauma. And I still remember myself, now that it's been many years since I worked my first day in the part of the emergency department where I had to run traumas. And I guess it gets built up so much because that trauma captain role is such an important player, right?
Absolutely.
Or to where like you don't do procedures, right? Because you are leading the room and you are guiding everyone else's interactions with the patient and each other. That's a great example of kind of the role players that all play.
Great example of it not exactly going the way that it should. But nevertheless, you learn from it and you go better, and it is what it is. Chris, this has been awesome. This has been absolutely amazing talking about this. I genuinely appreciate it. I think this kind of response pattern to problem sets is so interesting and so powerful, and also so fascinating to talk through both in and out of emergency medicine. I want to leave, though, with a chance for you to challenge folks, right, who are listening to this. Is there anything that you want them to do differently or better after they listen to this on Monday? And I'll tell you what, I'm going to help you cheat for a second, which is that while you're thinking about it, I'm going to say our standard disclaimer that I usually put at the end, which is that our job here at the Emergency Mind Project is to figure out the best of what any of us know about performance under pressure, not to provide medical advice. And anything that my guests and I talk about is, one, not medical advice, and two, our own opinions and not the opinions of any hospital or group that we work for or with. And hopefully that is enough of a disclaimer to buy you some time to come up with a challenge to issue to folks. So what are we going to do differently after listening to this? Yeah.
I would say in my career, the times when I've been able to successfully pilot or find solutions is when I've run into problems, right? And say, I can be frustrated by these problems and say, oh, I really don't want to run into that scenario again. Or I can say, if it was a problem that I had, I bet my colleagues have it too. And maybe there's a way to solve that problem. And as much as possible, try and do it without spending extra resources, right? That's the great thing about these teams, right? These are people who are already working, right? Mm-hmm. Say we pull people together to help solve a problem. And it's been in times when I've really felt like I need help. I feel helpless. Like I need people to come and help me think about a patient and do something. And so one example of one that I've recently introduced as a code GI, bleed, the opposite end of clotting that we've been talking about earlier, right? And to my knowledge, the only code GI bleed in the country. Mm-hmm. Right? To say, this is an example when I'm making multiple sequential phone calls. Instead of me just being nervous about the next time I'm seeing one of these really sick GI bleeding patients, let's pilot a protocol to solve the problem. And so what I would encourage people to do is when they see problems, think about how they can think of a solution that's resource neutral that could solve that problem for themselves and others in the future, and then be willing to pilot it, that solution. Because that kind of concept has served me well when I'm looking for wins in terms of operational innovations or solutions. The problems that I'm encountering are creating a roadmap for what my next project is. Instead of getting beat down by them, look at those as opportunities.
So cool. Chris, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Thank you for teaching me when I was a resident. Thank you for teaching me now and for teaching all of us. So thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much. This has been great.